From Psalm 119, for those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the importance of wholly, completely obeying God, and this was in conjunction with Saul's instructions to completely wipe out the Amalekites, if you can think back that far, and how he did pretty well. He almost got it done, but he didn't quite do it, and the result of that. But in Psalm 119, I was thinking of that as I was reading through this part of Psalm 119, beginning in verse 17. We'll start at 17 and read through 32 today. Deal bountifully with your servant, that I might live and keep your word. So, praying David's prayer here that God deals well with him, supplies him essentially, that he may live and keep his word, the purpose of his life. Open my eyes that I may see wonderful things from your law. I am a stranger in the earth. Do not hide your commandments from me. My soul is crushed with longing after your ordinances at all times. Just think about that. My soul is crushed with longing after your ordinances all the time. You rebuke the arrogant, the cursed, who wander from your commandments. Take away reproach and contempt from me, for I observe your testimonies. Even though princes sit and talk against me, your servant meditates on your statutes. Your testimonies are my delight. They are my counselors. My soul cleaves to the dust. Revive me to your word, according to your word. I have told of my ways, and you have answered me. Teach me your statutes. Make me understand the way of your precepts, so I will meditate on your wonders. My soul weeps because of grief. Strengthen me according to your word. Remove the false way from me and graciously grant me your law. I have chosen the faithful way. I have placed your ordinances before me. I cleave to your testimonies. O Lord, do not put me to shame. I will run the way of your commandments. The order there of the words is, the way of your commandments I will run, for you will enlarge my heart. Psalm 119, verses 17 through 32. Okay, so where we are in 1 Samuel is, last week Pastor Terry introduced us to the next section in 1 Samuel, which is the story of Saul and David together. The first part was kind of a transition to Saul as king, and then from chapters 9 to 15, Saul as king. And just a little refresher, since part of this was last year. 1 Samuel 8, verses 19 and 20, this will be a little refresher. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They're asking for a king, okay? And Samuel says no. And then they said, no, but we will have a king that we may be like all the nations. So the purpose of them wanting a king was to be like all the nations. And this is what they wanted from their king, that our king may judge us and may go out before us and fight our battles. So the two things they wanted from a king, and if you remember back, God says he is their king. He's the one who judges. He's the one who goes out for them, before them in battle, to fight for them. But they want to be like the other nations, to have somebody to do that. When Saul becomes king, this is what God says about him in chapter 9. He will save my people from the Philistines. And in chapter 12, And these were Samuel's instructions to the people. Here's what you need to do. Chapter 12, verses 24 and 25. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you will be swept away, both you and your king. And then in 1 Samuel 15, we saw what happened what that meant, acting wickedly, meant that Saul did not wholly obey, did not completely obey what the Lord commanded him. And obedience is not a 99% thing. Because he was pretty close to doing what he was supposed to do, but he didn't do it all. And as a response to that, God says in 1 Samuel 15, 23, because you have rejected the word of your Lord, of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. Yahweh has torn, verse 28, Yahweh has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you, who was introduced to us last time in chapter 16 with Pastor Terry. So he introduced David. He introduced Jesse, his father. He introduced his three oldest sons, Jesse's three oldest sons as well. Samuel anointed David. It didn't say that he anointed him as king. It just says he anointed him. And by the end of that chapter, here's the description of David. David is called. He's called a skillful musician, a man of valor, a warrior, handsome, prudent in speech, he was a good speaker, and Yahweh is with him. So that's how he's described at the end, toward the end of chapter 16. And Saul sees that this is a good thing, asks Jesse, David's father, if he will send him to live with him permanently, and David ends up serving as Saul's musician and as one of his armor bearers. And now we're moving on to chapter 17. And this is the story of David and Goliath, which everybody knows. So, any questions about David and Goliath? Actually, this chapter is really, really long, so it's probably good that we're at least somewhat familiar with it. But David and Goliath, we like that story because it's about underdogs. And in our society, we love sports, and there's always an underdog. And so there's always a David, and there's always a Goliath. Alabama's always a Goliath. but anyway, there's David and Goliath. But what is this story really about? And I'm going to tip you off that I think it's about the same thing that 1 Samuel is about what the rest of 1 Samuel is about. It's about the same thing that the Old Testament is about up to this point. It's about the same thing that's in the New Testament. It's a consistent thing here that God is communicating in different ways. This is one of those ways that God communicates his message from the story of David and Goliath. So let's pick it up at the beginning of chapter 17, because it is long. It's 50-some verses, 58 verses. I'll pause less often as we go through, but feel free to ask questions as we go along, make comments as we go along, because we all know this story, right? Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. So, very specific place where they were. About 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago now, I was in Israel with Brenda and with her mom, and I made them go here. I made them go to this place. It's really, if you've ever been to Israel, everywhere where Jesus might have done something, there's a church built, okay? So, but that's not the case for the Old Testament sites. And so it's not easy to find them. And in fact, what we did looked up, got pictures of what the mountain would look like, Soko and Azekah, and then drove to the general area and said, well, it's this one. It's this mountain. And that one over there, a couple miles away, that must be Azekah, and this brook here in between, which had no water in it, well, that must be Elah. And it is. And you go down there, and they waited in the car for me while I went down there and picked up five smooth stones, and then I said, well, other people should have five smooth stones. So I picked up more smooth stones and came back with like a sweatshirt full of smooth stones when I brought them back to the car. But it's the point is it's there, and it's like any other place in Israel. It's very surprising how plain and ordinary this site is. It's not a big, huge mountain range. It's little hills. And these people were gathered there, and you can go find it if you want. It's one of the really fun things to do if you go is to search out some of these Old Testament sites. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the other side, think hill, like the Black Hills, kind of maybe, that size. And Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley in between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion whose name was Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. Okay, so right away we come up to this part. The champion idea here isn't new. This was a common thing actually in battles between armies. You could avoid slaughtering each other if you were willing to go one-on-one with somebody, send your best guy up against their best guy, see who wins, and then your army wins if you win, and if you lose, you lose. It's kind of like playing one-on-one on basketball. Kind of like that. Send out LeBron James against, who's another good player? Steph Curry, see what happens there. But we have this thing where the guy's 10 feet tall almost, and the question is this a real story? Okay? If the guy's 10 feet tall, 9 feet 9, how can this be a real story when everybody was shorter back then than we are now? Well, when I was a kid, there was something called Guinness Book of World Records. Anybody know what that is? Anybody not know what that is? I don't know if they publish it anymore. Do they? They publish it still. So they list the tallest man in the world that can be verified by science as somebody from the United States who died in 1940. His name was Robert Wadlow. I think he was 22 when he died, I think, if I remember correctly. He was 8 feet 11. As I was reading one of the commentaries for this passage, there's somebody buried near Liverpool who they haven't dug up, I'm sure, from about 1600, who is reportedly 9 feet 3. So Goliath at 9 feet 9 you don't have to concede that this isn't a real story. You don't have to concede that they didn't know how to measure. People get tall. It's something to do with your medical people can correct me, but I think it's pituitary gland thing that makes people really, really tall, and some people don't quit growing. And so it happens. People get tall. The tallest Not very long ago, there was a guy playing in the Olympics from China who was over 8 feet tall. So people get tall. So he had, this is Goliath, this is how he's described. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. So the word for mail here is like scales, like a fish would have. So it looked like that. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, which is 126 pounds. So he's a big guy. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. And the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's about 15 pounds. And remember that one of the big advantages that the Philistines had over Israel was their arms superiority. Their weapons were just way better than Israel's weapons. They were the ones who could work iron. Israel could not. They didn't have that capability. They were reliant on the Philistines to get them iron, and who they weren't very willing to supply it to them. Because they were fighting. So the best they would have, Israel would have, was a few farm implements that were made of iron. And a shield bearer went out before him. So that's how he's described. Notice he's an imposing figure who's really tall, is fully covered. And he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel. Your version might say something different than ranks of Israel. The ESV, this word changes from time to time. I just switched them all to ranks so that you could know that this is how they're using what he's referring to, or what they're referring to with ESV. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not the Philistine? And are you not the servants of Saul?" So most of your versions will say, "Am I not a Philistine?" New American Standard says, "Or am I not the Philistine?" And that one is, according to Tsumura, who I like his commentary, that's the way it would read if you would naturally read it. I am the Philistine. This is what we are. I'm an example of a Philistine to you guys. This is who we are. And by the way, choose a man for yourself. Or am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? So this is the superiority we have. I'm the guy, and you guys are slaves of Saul. So choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." So you will see as you go through this chapter, defy is an important word. Okay, it's going to show up over and over again, and it's a key in how the thought process of Goliath, Saul, the Israelites, David think. Okay, the word defy here can mean taunt or reproach. Look on them with reproach. The original idea behind the word was that sharp. So I say sharp things against you, but don't miss that it's treating him with contempt, defying you, and holding contempt for you. I hold contempt for you as I defy you. That kind of an idea, and not just I challenge you or I dare you or something like that. So I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And Saul and Israel heard, these words of the Philistines, and they were dismayed and greatly afraid. They were shattered, would be another way to say this. They were devastated, would be another way to say this, and greatly afraid. They feared a great fear from this morning. Okay, this is what Israel did, what shepherds did when they saw angels. This is what Israel did when they saw Goliath. It's a very similar thing. Now, David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. Okay, so we were introduced to David and Jesse, and that Jesse had 8 sons, and that the 3 oldest sons in chapter 16. But here we're getting it again, so I'll comment about that in a few minutes. Now, David was the son of an Ephrathite in Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man, that says Jesse, was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest of sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. So they're already there. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, Abinadab, Shammah, and David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep in Bethlehem. So what's going on here? We've got a complete reintroduction to David in this part. And he is, and you're going to see, it seems to be a little bit different from what was in the last chapter. In the last chapter, he ended up, he was called a warrior, essentially. He's called a man of valor. He's called somebody who's prudent in speech. The Lord's with him. Saul's called for him to work for him full time, asked Jesse for that. And he appears to be doing that. So what's going on here? We'll go a little bit farther. Well, some think that there are 2. Basically, what we have here is somebody was writing 1 Samuel, not 1 Samuel, because it was one book. Somebody was writing, and Kings. But as somebody was writing this, there are different accounts of David. And we're just putting 2 of them together here. Okay, so here's the story I got from somebody, kind of like what happened with the Gospels. They're, before they were all written down, people were already talking about Jesus. So as they wrote them down, the Gospels, they were writing things. And the apostles had been there. So you've got, you know, Matthew, who's there writing the things that he knows. Mark is related to Peter. He's writing down the things that Peter has. Etc. So I don't want to get into too much detail about the theories of how they were composed, but the idea here is that there were probably, and this may be true, this may just be a place where there's another story put side by side that overlaps with the previous chapter. Okay, so my question is always, okay, how come whoever wrote this then, or whoever put it together, didn't fix this? Okay? Why did he reintroduce David? If that's the case, why did that happen? I think there is a really good explanation for that. It is in Sumura's commentary, but the big thing is it contrasts him with Saul. Saul is portrayed in one way. Goliath is portrayed in one way earlier in the chapter, is this military guy, imposing figure, and to borrow Randy's term from this morning, David is portrayed as somebody extraordinarily ordinary. He's just a guy with a dad and some brothers, okay? From a nearby town. That's who he is. Okay? And now you'll see that it makes sense to leave it here because that's the purpose. The purpose is to show you who Goliath was and who David was. And now as we go forward, the author of this jumps back and forth between the scenes, just like he's done here. Portray Goliath, portray David. Now I'm going to say something about Goliath, something that's going on with David at the same time. Goliath, David, back and forth as we go forward. So, verse 16, for 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to David, his son. So, I'm going to tell you about something what Goliath was doing. Now I'm going to tell you something about what David's doing. Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain, these 10 loaves, and carry them to the camp to your brothers. And take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well, and bring me some token from them, essentially so that I know that they're still alive. Bring me back something so that I know they're still alive in this battle. Back to Saul, or back to what's going on in the battle. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. And David, okay, contrasting what's going on in two different scenes here. And David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with his keeper, and took the provision and went, as Jesse had commanded him, and came to the encampment as the army was going to the battle line, shouting a war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, rank against rank. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. So one of the things that just jumps out to me is this idea that, and David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the battle. So earlier in 1 Samuel, we had a case where something happened with the baggage. Anybody remember that? Something happened with the baggage. I heard it. Saul hid in the baggage, right? So he's going to be anointed king. It's this deal where Samuel is selecting the king of Israel by lots, essentially. And everybody goes, well, the lot falls to Saul. Where is he? He's hiding in the baggage, in the stuff, okay, that everybody brought with them. He's hiding in that stuff. Here's a place where they're stockpiling provisions for the battle. And David comes to that place, and the battle's going on, and Israelites are really afraid, and what does he do? He could have hidden the baggage, right? He didn't hide in the baggage, okay? He ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked to them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before, and David heard. So a little while ago, I read what Saul did, and David's brothers did, and the Israelites did when they heard Goliath. They were shattered, devastated. They got afraid. And this verse ends with, and David heard. Interestingly, the major break in this verse, okay, verse 23, it's pretty long, right? The major break, so it's dividing the verse into two parts that are important. The verse breaks right before, and David heard. Two parts to the verse. That's what happens in Hebrew. You break it into its major parts. The major part, the second major part, the first part all goes together. The second part is, and David heard. In other words, pay attention to this. it's the big part of the big break in the verse. So when David hears, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. So he's repeating this. The author's repeating this. And the men of Israel said, Have you, this is plural, so they're talking to each other. Have you seen this man who has come up? They're talking about Goliath. He has surely come up to defy, there's that word again, Israel. The king will do this for, this is what the king's going to do if you can beat him. The king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches. He will give him his daughter, and he will make his father's house free in Israel. No taxes, that's what we're all after, right? So, anyway, three things. If you can defeat Goliath, this is what happens. And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the defiance from Israel?" The noun version of that word defy. So David has now shown up. These guys have been talking about what's going to happen. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the ranks of the living God? So the people have been talking about this. Goliath comes out and he says, I defy Israel. The people, when they hear it of Israel, go, what happens to the guy who kills this guy who has come up to defy Israel? David sees something different. They see that Goliath has come to defy Israel. David sees something different. He sees this. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the ranks of the living God? Okay. David sees that. I don't know if he quite sees omnipotent holiness here, but he does see almighty here. He does see that it isn't about Israel. It's about God. And David sees that Goliath is defying not Israel, God, the ranks of the living God. And the people answered him in the same way. So in the same way, that means he's going to make you rich, you get his daughter, and you're going to be free in Israel. So they answered him the same way. So shall it be done to the man who kills him. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." So he's irritated, and he also assumes that David has shirked his responsibilities. He's left the sheep. They don't have very many of them. He's supposed to be a shepherd. He's the youngest. You're just coming down to get an eyeful of what's going on in this battle. So essentially go back home. And David said, what have I done now, right? This is, when we read this a few months ago in our, we've got a small group that gets together on Saturday mornings and reads, we learned that in Hebrew. What have I done now? Thought it would be useful when I went home. was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward one another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before when the words that David spoke were heard. And they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him." Now don't forget that all of Israel, including Saul, all the warriors, their heart was failing, right? So don't let anybody's heart fail, by the way, including yours. "Your servant will go and fight the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, And he has been a man of war since his youth. Now, this doesn't, it doesn't fit chronologically if we just start thinking about it. He was already described as, David was already described as a man of war. So there has to be some way to put these stories together. I think it does make sense that they overlap each other. And so at this time anyway, David is described as somebody as a youth without military experience, because it's not mentioned. And David doesn't even describe himself as having military experience as we come up here. So there has to be some kind of an overlap there. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father." So this is what I used to do. "And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went with him, went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth." So he's a deliverer, which is one of the things that a king does, by the way. "And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them." Why? "Because he has defied the ranks of the living God." That's why. Again, David sees that this is about more than Israel. He sees that it is about defying the ranks of the living God. "And David said, Yahweh," or the Lord, "who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the bear, paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said, okay, so Saul, remember, he's the king. He's in charge of this army. Shepherd boy comes up, offers to go fight the Philistine. And Saul says, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." So how desperate was he? Seriously. How desperate was he? The Philistines, this battle takes place in, and notice at the beginning it said in Judah, so it's in their territory. The Philistines are pushing up from the west and the southwest into Israel, coming from the southwest. They're in Judah's territory. It's about, I'm thinking it's like 15, 20 miles from Jerusalem, which they don't own yet. Israel doesn't own yet. Doesn't own Jerusalem yet even. They own Bethlehem, which is, as Randy pointed out, 5 miles from Jerusalem, but they don't own Jerusalem. So they're getting squished here as they come forward. Saul's desperate. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. Let's fight the way we're supposed to fight, Saul thinks. At least we're going to give him some armor, right? Because this is what we do. We have to make sure that we have the right weapons and the right armor if we're going to go fight this guy. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head. He clothed him with a coat of mail. This is just like Goliath, right? I don't see anything on his legs. And David strapped his sword over his armor. So he had a javelin strapped. Goliath had a javelin strapped to his back. And he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. So he'd never had this stuff on before. And David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." So David took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook that was probably dried up, because it's dried up most of the year. And he put them in his shepherd's pouch with his sling in his hand, and he approached the Philistines. Now, one of the things that we often think about is that a sling is just something that shepherds had, not a very good weapon. Somebody turned to Judges 20:16. And when you get it, just kind of blurt it out. Judges 20:16. So this is what a sling is.
"Among all his people were 700
Okay? They were really good with slings. They could be really good. And the hair isn't like a rabbit, right? Like a hair on your head. They had 700 left-handed guys that could were so good that you would describe them if they could sling it at a hair and not miss. So they're really accurate, okay? But, so David takes something like this, and he approaches the Philistine, and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with the shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. In other words, David was a pretty boy, right? And because that is the way, so ruddy there means like reddish brown, and which was, as pointed out in several places, that's actually the ideal look for somebody at this time. If you could be ruddy, if you could be kind of reddish looking, that is a good thing. So the Philistine looks at him and disdains him. And the Philistine said to David, now this wouldn't be uncommon. There would be trash talking at this time as well, especially if it's going to be one-on-one combat. Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Same word as it is for staff, but the plural. So I think every major translation does it with sticks, because it is a taunt. It is trash talking. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. That's the first time we see something like that here with regard to Goliath. He decides to bring the Philistine gods into this battle. Maybe not a good idea. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. And then David said to the Philistine, he trash talks too, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin. So you think that my sticks are overmatched. I think your sword and your spear and your javelin are overmatched. So is that all you got? I mean, that's the idea here. Is that all you got is military superiority? You got the best weapons, that's it? That's all you have is the best weapons? See, David gets it. David gets the way that we're supposed to think. Is that all you have? Is that all you got when you're coming against us? I mean, we love this passage in the New Testament. Ephesians starts in Ephesians 6:10, talks about the armor of God, right? Talks about our battle isn't against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces, etc. Interestingly, a little sidetrack here. It doesn't say, so then, since our battle is against, not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces, it doesn't say to do this. I call by the name of Jesus for you to do this to an evil spirit. It doesn't tell us to do that. It tells us to put on faith, put on truth, put on righteousness. Kind of what should be extraordinarily ordinary things for us as Christians. Put those things on. It doesn't tell us to do extraordinary things. Just put these things on. Just put them on when you're in a battle. And so David does that in a sense, and he says, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of armies. As Randy said this morning, in the sky with the shepherds, the Lord of armies. That's what the angels are. That's what the hosts are. I come to you in the name of the Lord of armies, of Yahweh of armies, the God of the ranks of Israel, whom you have defied. So back to David's thing here. You're defying God, and I'm coming with his name, and he's the God of the armies. This day, Yahweh will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the bodies of the camp of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth. So why is David confident in this? Why does David know what's going to happen here? We can say faith, yes, true. It's also what this whole story is about, and it's what the story has been about to this point in Samuel. Israel wanted a king. God was their king, right? He was able to deliver them. They wanted to be like the other nations. And here's what it says, what this story is about. Why? That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. I'm going to talk about this for a little bit. Okay, so that there is a God in Israel. I looked at all of the, I shouldn't say all, I looked at a lot of the major versions here. But when I was reading it beforehand, this is not the translation that I come up with. And so I went and checked all the versions and then read some commentaries. And does anybody have something that says that all the earth, that doesn't say that there is a God in Israel? Something that says something different from that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Anybody say something different from that? Right before that. The verse before that. Yep, so that the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Okay, there are only two places in the whole Bible where these words are used in a phrase. A God translated in Israel here. I'll take you to the other one because I think it's better. 1 Chronicles 17:24. 1 Chronicles 17:24. Which is right after 1 Kings, right? 17:24. And I think it captures the meaning here way better. Somebody want to read 1 Chronicles 17:24, and then we'll talk about this. This is David's. This is when, shortly after David has brought back the ark to Jerusalem, put it in a tent, put it in a tabernacle, and the covenant with David. Someone read that for me? 17:24. Okay, good. That's the old New American Standard, isn't it? That's mine. That's what I'm looking at, too. How about an NIV or an ESV?
So that it will be established and that your name will be great forever. Then men will say, the Lord Almighty, the God over Israel, is Israel's God.
There you go. Israel's God. That's the phrase. That's the one that's a God, or God in Israel, in the other place. So it's the preposition used there would normally be used as belonging to or for. And so that's how it's used here. Israel's God. The God belonging to Israel. The God who is for Israel would be another way to say that. Again, there's only two places this is used. The normal way to say in Israel is different. A God in Israel is different, and that occurs several other places. But this only occurs in these two places, and the normal way to read this would be, and several of the commentaries have picked it up also, that all the earth may know that there is a God for Israel. A God who is working for Israel, who is Israel's God. Not just that the God is in Israel. There's a God who is for Israel. That's what this is about. That there's a God for Israel. David knows that he's going to win because Goliath has defied the God, has defied Yahweh, and he's the God for Israel. And then the second reason that this thing is about is, and that all this assembly, so that means that's now the people of Israel, will know that Yahweh saves not with sword and spear, or it is not by sword and spear that Yahweh saves. He doesn't save by sword and spear. It doesn't. That's not what he does, okay? He doesn't win. He doesn't need the weapons, just like David didn't need the weapons. God fights differently. Weapons don't mean anything to God. Why don't weapons mean anything to God? Next part. Because the battle belongs to Yahweh. The whole thing belongs to him. Weapons don't matter. And as we've talked about before, odds don't matter. None of that matters. God fights differently. The weapons do not win these battles when you're fighting with God. The weapons don't win the battles. So, in case we missed it in Exodus, when the people are standing on the edge of the Red Sea, and what does God say? Hey, I'm going to let Egypt know that I'm God. And you guys need to know that I'm God, right? That's what that was about. Earlier, when Saul and Jonathan overcome forces of innumerable foot soldiers combined with 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horses, and they have like 600 guys. It's not about the weapons. It's not about the number of people fighting the battle. God does that. David still has to fight, don't forget. David still has to use the sling, but he certainly doesn't have superiority. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to David, this is in verse 48, and David ran quickly toward the rank to meet the Philistines. And David put his hand in his bag and took a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face on the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. In case you missed it, David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. And there was no sword in the hand of David. Okay? Don't forget, it's not about the weapon, right? It's not about the weapons. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword. So he takes the Philistine's sword. God switches things around. And drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. Killed him and cut off his head. Then the Philistines saw that their champion was dead. They fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaaraim as far as Gath and Ekron. Okay. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp, and David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. So he takes the head and brought it to Jerusalem. Israel doesn't own Jerusalem yet, so a little bit of a, well, I wonder what happened there. Maybe he brought it later. And as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, so this, now this is as soon as, so this is out of sequence. As soon as Saul saw David go out to the Philistine, so when was that? That was a while ago, right? So this is, it has to tell you what was going on because he didn't want to interrupt the story for this. So here's what was going on at that time. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, somewhere probably in, you know, like verse 38, 39, somewhere in that range is when this happened. This is verse 55. He said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" It appears anyway that Saul doesn't know who this is really yet. Who does he belong to? I mean, so, and Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I don't know. I don't know." So the commander of the army doesn't know who David is, where he comes from. Saul doesn't know who David is, apparently. And the king, because he says in verse 56, go ask whose son this boy is. Go inquire whose son this is. And as soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, jumps ahead a little bit now, so the battle's happened. As soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, but before he took his head to Jerusalem, right? So as soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite."
Ha.
It's quitting time. thank you for bearing with us on this 58 verses of 1 Samuel 17. See you next week.